I'm pleased to welcome you to the Technology Management Program's first lecture of this fall quarter at UCSB. And we are honored to have Harris Simmons with us. He is the Chairman, President, and Chief Executive Officer of Zions Bank Corporation, the Chairman of Zions First National Bank, and Director of Questar Corporation and O.C. Tanner Company. Simmons is a past president of the American Bankers Association and graduate of University of Utah, and has his MBA from Harvard University. Our theme tonight is The Right Start, Building Great Relationships with Your Bankers and Other Financial Constituents. So please join me in welcoming Harris Simmons to the stage.
Well, thank you very much. It's great to be with you. This has really been a fascinating day spent on your beautiful campus. What a tough place to go to school. I hadn't realized when Bill Grant asked if I would come and join you today how integrated and interdisciplinary your program here is. And I think it's a fascinating approach to helping people with technical backgrounds understand what goes on in the real world of trying to find financing, et cetera, and vice versa. I mean, this is really a wonderful approach, and one I greatly admire as I've learned more about it. My objective today is going to be to help you understand a little about something that many of you, in one form or another, are going to run into as you leave school and go out and start careers. Some of you will start businesses, not all of you, but many of you will have, I suspect, the opportunity at some point to be involved in trying to find financing for a project, even if it's within an organization. A lot of the principles I'm going to talk about here today, I suspect, will apply. And I thought I'd help introduce you to what it is like to be a banker with a little poem. I don't have PowerPoint slides. I'm not much into that. I just wanted to talk to you. But I come from Salt Lake City, and out in Elko, Nevada, every year they have a wonderful cowboy poetry festival. And you find a lot of wonderful truth in some of the some of these poems. This is by Baxter Black, it's from from a book, Croutons on a Cow Pie. But there's a little thing about bankers. He says that the banker took his ledger out, the rancher took a seat. Let's see, I lent you 20 thou. For cattle, corn, and wheat, let's talk about your cattle first. Well, the rancher's face looked pained. You know how bad the market's been. I've lost 15, he explained. 15 what? 15 cents a pound? 15 died of thirst? Nope, $15,000 lost, but hey, it could be worse. The banker swallowed hard, then asked, well, what about your grain? Well, the hoppers ate up all my wheat, and the sweet corn needed rain. The pig got sick, my son got drunk and joined the Mooney's church. I figure I'm down 40 thou, but hey, it could be worse. What do you mean it could be worse? That ain't even funny. And the rancher shrugged and then replied, it could have been my money. So the first job of a banker is to get the money back, and sometimes that's easier than others. We're entering a period, I think, in our economy right now, which I hope will not be a totally major downturn, as all of you are out to start looking for jobs soon. But I do think we're entering a period in the economy which is full of risk. The housing market is in some kind of shambles, really, and I think that could go on for a couple of years, and may have implications for the broader economy, and it makes the job of bankers like myself much more interesting than it is in good times, because we find ourselves dealing with how do you work with borrowers that are experiencing stress. We're working with a number of them right now. They're home builders, for example, here in California. They're experiencing a lot of stress to make sure that the outcome is good for both of us. But let me tell you a little about some background on my organization. Zions Bank Corporation is the third largest financial services company in the West that is headquartered in the Western United States, independent company headquartered here, after Wells Fargo and Washington Mutual. And it's a name you've probably never heard of, but we have about 500 offices in 10 states. Here in California, we operate as California Bank and Trust. And if any of you are from down in, particularly from San Diego or Orange County, you may have seen the San Diego or the California Bank and Trust name. We operate with local names and local in various markets. It's a company that has a really interesting history. It goes back to 1873. Brigham Young, who was a Mormon colonizer of kind of the mountain states, created a bank back in 1873 to help finance some of the new businesses that were starting up out on the western frontier. And that was a predecessor to the organization we have today, and it grew over time. And back in 1960, my father, together with three or four investors, acquired the bank and took it public in 1965. So today we're actually a reasonably large public company. We have a market cap, which is a market capitalization, which is the total number of shares times the price per share on the open market of about $8 billion. So we have a business that we operate from down in Texas, on across the kind of the Southwest, and Arizona, Nevada, Colorado, Utah, Idaho, California, and up into the Northwest, up in Seattle and Portland. And we finance thousands of businesses. So I have a fair amount of experience in seeing how businesses get financed and how they succeed and how they fail. We have about 185,000 businesses that are customers. Many of them are smaller businesses. Most of them would be. Many of them owned by entrepreneurs. And one of the things I'm going to do today is to talk a little about some of the people I've met along the way and some lessons I think you'll learn from them. My own background, Brittany gave you a little bit of a dose of it, but I grew up in a banking family, and I learned a lot about the business just around the kitchen table from my father. I was hauled off to work the week after I turned 16. My dad was intent on making sure that one of his kids ended up in the business, and I was the one. I was his third try, and I was the one that stuck. But he took me off and got me started filing canceled checks. And I worked in a lot of different areas, and as a teller and in an investment operation and a lot of different areas. But I worked my way through school, got a degree in economics at the University of Utah, and then I went off to Harvard Business School and got an MBA, and wrote a lot of case studies on the banking industry. One of the things I did along the way as I was mentioning this earlier today to a couple of you during the lunch hour, I think one of the really smart things I did when I got out of school, out of graduate school, I had some offers that were really attractive from some great kind of household name companies. But I had become intrigued with a fabulous company down in Houston, Texas, by the name of Allied Bank Shares. As I was writing case studies, I really became interested in how Allied Bank shares kept kind of appearing on lists of the best performing banks in the industry. And so I determined I wanted to go down and visit with them, and that led to an interest in working for them. And I mention it because this was back in 1980, and I went to work at Allied Bank of Texas, their subsidiary, for $18,000 a year. And that was roughly half of what my best offer was. I mean, inflation's taken those numbers up since then, but it was roughly 50% of my best kind of monetary offer. But I viewed that as an opportunity to continue my education. I figured there was a lot I could learn from that company. And that really turned out to be the case. And it turned out to be an experience that was invaluable and later led to our being able to complete 2 years ago the largest acquisition that our company ever made for $1.7 billion. We acquired a bank called Amegy Bank of Texas, which was started by a number of the people who had been at Allied, which was subsequently acquired by Wells Fargo, and they'd started another company. But those relationships and what I'd learned from them mattered a lot, and I leave that as a little bit of advice or something you might think about as you're making your own plans after school as to what you want to do. Find an organization that can teach you something in a company or an organization that you deeply admire. And once you're on the inside of it, there will be all kinds of opportunity to move around. But I just think the best advice I can give anybody coming out of school is don't be lured away by just a paycheck. Think about what the experience is going to teach you that prepares you to do great things throughout your career. One of the things that I think is maybe notable about our company is that we're reasonably entrepreneurial in our own right. It's something that we really value, and because many of you are studying technologies that will lead you into entrepreneurial careers, I thought I'd take a minute and tell you about some of the things that some of the experiences that I've had in what is, by any measure, a reasonably stodgy traditional industry, commercial banking. Maybe help you understand that there are actually some interesting things happening in it. We for example, back in the mid-90s, we became a real pioneer in the use of digital certificates and digital signatures, which some of you will be familiar with. It's become a little more familiar in the authentication of parties to transactions over the internet. And it became we got thinking about the fact that in an era of online commerce, that it was going to be really important if you're trying to, for example, in our business, to make a mortgage online with somebody that you haven't actually met, that making sure that if you're dealing with Sally Jones, that it's really Sally Jones, that becomes really important when Sally Jones doesn't make the payments and you need to maybe foreclose on a house. And so being able to create an environment and an infrastructure in which you could securely and with deep assurance conduct commerce over the internet was going to, we figured, involve something more than a password a username and a password. And so we started looking around. We saw the whole area of public key encryption, and that infrastructure was, it seemed to us, an area in which banks could actually have a real advantage, in that we actually know our customers pretty well. It's really part of what we have to do. We authenticate people. If you think about it, something as simple as cashing a check, I mean, that's just kind of part of the process that we have built. And we also figured, well, we have the advantage of being a trusted third party. Banks operate trust, a lot of banks operate a trust business where we're a fiduciary, where we're someone you trust to be in the middle of a transaction. We said, you know, this could be a great opportunity. And so we created a company known as Digital Signature Trust Company. And took banking regulators to school, if you will, taught them about the technology, and went through a lot of approval process. And anyway, commercialized the use of digital certificates. And we found, I mean, you know, one of the lessons we learned is that it remains to this day a fabulous concept. We'd started a company shortly thereafter. We found that others thought this was a good idea. There was a consortium consisting of about 7 of the 10 largest banks in the world that got together to set up a competing company. We'd, in the meantime, gathered a lot of federal government contracts, and but we were finding that the adoption of this technology was painstakingly slow. And so we ended up, at the end of the day, combining our company with Identrust, which was this consortium competitor. And the company's still out there, and it's now starting to, my belief is that in the next few years you'll hear a lot more about Identrust, because it's a technology that's really needed in the online world that we're all increasingly living in. And interestingly, if any of you interested, if you dig into your browser, you will find, if you dig into the Internet Explorer, I think if you go to Internet Tools, Options, Security, someplace in there, you'll find a list of what are called the certificate authorities, and you'll find Digital Signature Trust Company there. So we've got this technology actually embedded in all of your PCs, ready to unleash someday on the world. But that was kind of an unusual thing for a commercial bank to be engaged in. We've more recently been very involved in some kind of interesting payments, the commercialization of some new payments technologies. And, I think so often people think about technology in the realm of audiovisual communications. But if you think about it, one of the things that, something in all of our lives that we take way for granted is the ability to transact and to pay with a check or electronically, but to just to conduct commerce and the flow of money that takes place so reasonably effortlessly in the economy. Well, one of the things that dawned on us a few years ago was that there are tens of thousands of bank branches around the United States. And in an era where I dare say most of you probably don't go into bank branches very often, and you're using debit cards, you're using direct deposit, you're using online banking, ATMs, so all these different channels, and it sort of begs the question, what are all these bank branches doing out there? Well, what they're doing out there is they're still a lot of paper checks that are written, and that's one of the major rationales for their existence, is people have to have a place to go deposit all of this paper. And we have a wonderful guy, Dan Buchanan, who came to me about 10 years ago, and he said, I've been trying to figure out with other banks for some years now how to exchange images of these checks as opposed to the physical paper. But he said the problem is that there are 9,000, 10,000 or so banks in the United States. And as long as even a few of them aren't sort of connected, interconnected into the same kind of operating platform, it's the exchange of images really doesn't work, because there are some of them are still going to require paper, and now what you have is just a duplicate process. He said, and he behind every great invention, I guess, there's sort of this aha moment where he said, you know, there's a less elegant solution that gets you most of the benefit. And that is, if you could actually scan the check and then send the image of that to a distant point close to where the bank is that's going to pay the check, and then reproduce the paper and present that paper, that copy of the check to the paying bank, you would have eliminated all of the transportation and the float, which is the delay, because there's this time value of money from the time the check is deposited to the time it's paid, typically a day or two. You'd eliminate all of that and replace it with the cost of creating a, printing a piece of paper. But he said, it sounds a little clunky, but the beauty of it is that every bank can participate in that process because it's the same process, because they all know how to process paper. And so we went out and we hired a consulting firm, a highly regarded firm, to kind of validate this concept. We ended up demonstrating this with the vice chairman of the Federal Reserve Board back in July of 2001, because the Federal Reserve Board actually regulates the payment system in the United States. And it was sort of a little dog and pony show. And about 2 months later, we had September 11th. And something interesting happened in the payment system as a result of that. All the planes in the United States were grounded. And that's how all these checks are flown around, believe it or not. If somebody sends you a check from Boston and you deposit it here in Santa Barbara, that check, it's physically flown back to Boston tonight or tomorrow to get paid. And it gets deposited first probably at the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco's Los Angeles branch, and then they send it on a private plane to Boston. Well, all these planes were grounded, so they couldn't clear these checks, and it was a huge problem for them. They had billions of dollars of these payments piling up that they couldn't get sorted out. They called us up and they said, that demonstration we did back in July, we ought to go back and take a look at that. And long story short, that turned into a piece of legislation passed by Congress about a year later, which is known as the Check 21 Act, which revolutionized the check clearing industry. And that's something we've commercialized, and we've licensed it, the technology, to a lot of large banks, and it's starting to revolutionize the way businesses clear checks. So I mentioned a couple of examples like this. We have another one in the medical payments business where we have some very clever software we've developed to help healthcare providers reconcile insurance claims, and we're seeing a lot of interest in that. We've got some kind of interesting little businesses that we're trying to build. I mention it because I feel like I've had probably more than the typical experience of a banker in trying to create some startup businesses on my own, and understand some of the challenges of starting a new business. It's tougher than you think until you've been there, but a huge amount of fun. I found, as a result, that even in banking, there's room for some real entrepreneurship and figuring out better new ways to do things. Even with traditional products like just a mortgage, the greatest moment of my life professionally, I think, probably came one day in 1993 when I was thinking about refinancing my home. I had about $50,000 that I owed on a mortgage on my house, and it was a kind of a high rate, interest rate, and rates had come down. I thought, I ought to refinance this little mortgage I've got. And I thought, geez, it's really complicated to do that. I've got to get an appraiser to come up to my house, and then I've got to leave work and go up and meet the appraiser. And I thought of all the hassle of going through this, and I thought, why is it that as bankers, why do we make it so much more difficult to get a mortgage on a house than, say, a loan on a car. A house is, after all, a better piece of collateral. It doesn't go anywhere. It doesn't depreciate nearly as much as a car does. And I got thinking about it. I realized, well, it's because all the mortgages we make are sort of made for sale into what's called the secondary market. We sell them to organizations known as Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac, and they're made to their specifications, and they require certain things. And I thought, you know, what I really wanted wasn't a 30-year mortgage. I wanted like a 7-year mortgage just to get the lower rate and get my house paid off. And so we did some work on that. And 2 weeks later, this was a really quick product launch, but 2 weeks later we introduced a 7-year fully amortizing fixed rate mortgage. And we said no fees, no points, no hassle. We're going to use your tax valuation notice to figure out what the value of the house is. We also figured that anybody who wanted to pay to amortize their mortgage in 7 years as opposed to 30 was likely to be a pretty good credit risk, because most people are, you know, if they're living on the edge, they're trying to stretch things out and make the smallest payment they can. We figured anybody who wants to actually accelerate their payments is likely to be a better credit risk. So we launched this product, and it's been phenomenally successful. It's made us millions of dollars. And it was all from just kind of looking at something that we'd all gotten used to looking at the same way, looking at it differently. So I mean, a few thoughts about some of my own entrepreneurial ventures. But most of my time is actually spent either doing a couple of things. It's actually just kind of the day-to-day management of what's a reasonably large bank, which means that I look at, in any given week, probably 25 to 30 deals. By deals, I'm talking extensions of credit, loans to companies. And these tend to be loans from kind of anywhere from $5 to $75 million, and that's kind of our bread and butter kind of business. And I also spent a lot of time looking at other kinds of deals, which are acquisitions of banks. This is an industry that's consolidated a lot, and so I've spent a lot of time in the last 20 years or so working on acquisitions, and have done dozens of them. But along the way, all of this has given me a lot of kind of insight, I think, into what it takes both to build a business and then to build great relationships with bankers, and not just bankers, but providers of funds. I think of some of our very largest customers today, who in many cases started off as very small customers. And my great hope for some of you is that you'll start off as a very small customer of a bank and become one of its largest. But I wanted to tell you about kind of three of these people, just to give you some insight, maybe from my perspective, into some people who built great businesses. All three of these individuals have built great businesses that are not, these aren't technology zillionaires of the sort that you're so accustomed to in this state. These are people who have built sort of old-fashioned great businesses in really some tough industries. And it's been fascinating to me to see what it takes to build a great business when you don't have sort of this eureka, you know, if you didn't create Google or something of that sort. The first person I want to tell you about for a minute is a tremendous individual by the name of Earl Holding. Earl Holding actually, they have a home here in Santa Barbara, a family that is, they're fabulous people. Earl was, as a kid, he was a son of a custodian, custodian for some apartment complexes in downtown Salt Lake City, Utah. And Earl grew up poor, and but he was extremely industrious and thrifty. I mean, he saved everything he ever made as a kid. And he went out and started mowing lawns. And the owner of the apartment complex, a man by the name of Covey, Mr. Covey saw Earl out there mowing lawns. I mean, the most industrious kid he'd ever seen. One day, later in life, Earl had gone into the service during World War II, and he got out, and Mr. Covey approached him, and he said, "I'm going to build a truck stop up in Wyoming. They're going to put in a new highway up there," which became Interstate 80. And there are long stretches of road where you have a lot of trucking traffic and there's just nothing up there. And he said, "I think I'm going to build a truck stop. Would you be willing to go up and manage it for me?" And Earl said, "Yeah, I'll do that if you'll give me a first right of refusal to buy it if you ever decide to sell it, because if I do it, I want to really build it into something great for you." And they worked out a little arrangement, and that eventually happened. He acquired this little truck stop up in Wyoming, out in the middle of, I don't know if any of you have ever driven through Wyoming on I-80, but if you have, you've seen Little America is the name of it. Little America is this little oasis in the middle of no place. And Earl, as a young man, turned that into a business that before long was pumping more gas than any gas station in the state of Wyoming. I mean, he was pumping. I mean, it was showing up on everybody's charts as what's going on out there. And they added a restaurant and then some rooms. And to this day, it remains a fabulous place to stop and get a really good meal and very popular place with truckers. Well, he came to us back in the early 60s, and we financed that purchase and have been very close since. And today, the holdings own Sinclair Oil Company. They own the Sun Valley Ski Resort, the Snow Basin Ski Resort in Utah, half a dozen really good hotels, cattle ranches up in Wyoming that are some of the most beautiful ranches in America. And as I've watched Earl over the years, I mean, a couple of things struck me. One is the work ethic. It's just incredible. I mean, this is somebody who's he and his wife Carol have made their business is also where they find fun. And I one of the things I've noticed in people who are really successful in a financial sense, I mean, who make lots of money building businesses, they don't really have a personal life and then a work life. It's all integrated, and they view this as part of, you know, what they want to do with their life is create something great that serves other people, and along the way they become financially successful. I remember driving to the airport one Sunday morning, 5:30 a.m. a few years ago, and Earl, who was then in his mid-70s, I drove past their home. I was trying to catch a very early morning flight, and I drove past, and there was a light on up in his library. 5:30 on a Sunday morning, and I knew what he was doing. He was, because that's how he starts every day. He's up at kind of 5 o'clock at work, there at home. So that's he's created this phenomenal company. And the other thing I'd say about Earl is, you know, his family has a couple of daughters and a son. They all work in the business, and you see them wouldn't be out of the norm at all. If you're up at Sun Valley eating in one of their restaurants up there, you wouldn't know it. But to have Kathleen or Steve or, you know, one of the kids pouring water into your glass or mowing the lawns, or I mean, they dig in and work with the help, and just a fabulous family. Another example of a great entrepreneur I've known in my time is Larry Miller. Larry is the owner of the Utah Jazz NBA basketball team, but he really made his money by selling cars. And he started as the manager of the parts department of a Toyota dealership in Denver, Colorado. And I met Larry first back in the early 1980s, I guess, when we were providing some financing to buy a Toyota dealership in Salt Lake City. Today he has, I don't know, some 35 to 40 automobile dealerships, one of the largest car dealers in the United States. And he has a chain of movie theaters. He owns, because he likes cars, he has one of the great racetracks in America out west of Salt Lake City. But he has a phenomenal business across the western United States with all these dealerships. Larry is one of the things that I've learned from Larry is, I mean, he has all the same attributes in terms of work ethic. Really hard worker. He has one of the most amazing minds for numbers I've ever met. I've had the experience over the years of meeting with Larry once a year and kind of reviewing his business with the relationship manager that handles it, who invites me along, and I occasionally am able to go along. We'll sit down and take kind of 3 hours. And Larry, without any notes whatsoever, can go through every one of his dealerships, his sports franchise, he has a broadcasting business as well, theaters, restaurants. And he can go through and talk in amazing detail about the performance of any of it. And he does, he lives in these numbers. He's very numbers driven. And I think, you know, one of the little elements of advice I'd have for anybody who really wants to succeed in business is, yeah, you need to master sort of what the business is, but you also need to live in the numbers of the business. Because that's how you keep score. That's one of the things I've learned from Larry, who's really a wonderful fellow. A third example comes to mind, and that's an old fraternity brother of mine, Dan Hewish. Dan is a very interesting character. We were fraternity brothers, the Sigma Chi fraternity, back in the 70s. And I didn't see a lot of him because Dan was off sort of experimenting a lot. He had a job working for Sears, selling, among other things, detergent to industrial users of detergent, like big laundries, hotels, etc., that use detergent. And it was a business that Sears happened to be in. And that got him really interested in what goes into laundry detergent. Now, how many people stop and think about this? Not very many. But he went off and kind of figured it out, and he went off and started experimenting, making laundry detergent in a cement mixer, the kind that you do if, you know, pour a backyard patio with. And he figured out how to do it. And he started a little business making laundry detergent. Happily, we provided a little bit of financing early on. We'd known his father was a customer, and so we gave him a little bit of credit, and he started building this business, which today is the largest manufacturer of private label manufacturer of laundry detergent in the world. So if you go into Walmart or Costco or Kmart or Albertsons or virtually any grocery store in America and buy their house brand of detergent, you're buying Dan Hewish's laundry detergent, which all started in the cement mixer. He recently sold that company to a private equity firm and did very, very well. But it's fascinating to me because this isn't a high-tech business. It's a very traditional sort of old-line, mature manufacturing business. In the same way that Sinclair is, you know, operating gas stations, selling cars. I mean, one of the great things about my business is you see all these stories and you get to know these people that have created amazing businesses, and they're not necessarily with great new technology. Some of them are just by going out and doing something better, with better service, cleaner restrooms, better food, you name it, cheaper price. And it's a wonderfully, just an amazing economy I think we live in that allows that kind of creativity to take place. So those are some of the a few examples. If you think about financing a startup business, many of you know this, but for those who may not have been exposed to it, I mean, banks aren't typically the first place you go to finance a startup. There are kind of several tiers, I mean, of financing that, and providers that you go to. Venture capitalists typically provide kind of early capital. Most early capital for most startup businesses is going to be your personal savings, taking out a second mortgage on your house, scraping everything together, using your credit cards, doing everything possibly wrong that you could do if I'm giving you good financial advice. But you're going to take a great big risk, and some of them won't work out, and you'll be miserable as a result. But it takes a lot of passion and a willingness to take those kinds of risks to get a business off the ground. Businesses that then get off the ground, quite often you'll end up talking to a venture capitalist, people who have a tolerance for quite a lot of risk, because getting something off a launch pad is, like I say, it's very hard. Banks tend to come in a little later in the process. A little about the economics of a commercial bank. For every dollar we lend out, we put up, our own shareholders put up typically about 6 cents. The other 94 cents comes from borrowed money, mostly from depositors. And so we take that money, and so we're very highly leveraged, which means that we can operate with very small margins, very kind of skinny margins relative to what a venture capitalist might be looking for. But those skinny margins make credit affordable once a lot of the risk is taken out by a venture capitalist or by somebody who's taking the real risk that the business will simply survive. So because we have a lot of leverage, and because we're highly regulated, there is not a lot of room for us to take a whole lot of risk. If we're doing our job right, we'll have about 25 to 35 basis points, or that's hundredths of a percentage point, of loss in our portfolio every year. Now that turns out to be pretty low risk kind of stuff. So if you're starting a business, probably the first place you're going to go is someplace other than a bank. Though as banks, we try to get in early. We use SBA loans and methods, you know, try to find government guarantees and ways to help you out as early as we can. But typically, we come in a little later on as the business starts to generate some cash. But as you get to that point, so I wanted to give you maybe four or five sort of tips, if you will, in terms of how you build the kind of relationship with a banker that will allow you to get financing on the best terms you possibly can, and that will make sure that will help ensure that when you go through some of the down cycles and some of the bumps along the way, that you have a banker who's going to stand by you and support your business. The first thing I would suggest is that you have to have a well thought out business plan and really know your business. I mean, this gets back to some of what I was just talking about with some of these examples, is really understanding how you're creating value, and to have thought through all the things that can go wrong and be knowledgeable about your competitors. And you need to be a real student of the business before you're going to really be able to succeed. Because most every business, unless you have a really amazing patentable idea, you're going to find yourself competing with a lot of other established competitors. And so it becomes really important to a banker that you both have some capital in place to, you know, to provide some cushion, that you have some of your own money at risk, but you also really know the business. But once you do that, I mean, that's kind of basic. A second imperative, I think, from a banker's point of view, is that you know your numbers well, that you have a strong financial officer in a business, they have somebody who's really competent and that is reliable in terms of putting out reliable financial information in a timely manner. I mean, that, if there's anything that drives a banker a little nuts, it's information that may be suspect or that isn't timely, or who you feel like maybe they're kind of wandering in the woods a little bit. So having a strong financial person in the business, so you have strong controls, financial controls, and timely information would be a second. A third would be and sort of just totally fundamental to all of this is absolute honesty in the way you communicate with anybody providing you money. I've had the experience on too many occasions, I guess, in my career, where you're dealing with a customer who wants to, when bad news comes along, they want to sort of they don't want to tell you about it. They want to see if they can make it better before they alarm you with the news. That's absolutely the wrong way to deal with anybody who's providing money to you, whether it's a partner providing equity, a banker providing debt. Be absolutely forthright. I think a great way to go about this is to, if you think about making a commitment that you're going to be proactive in communicating every month about what's going on in your business, write a letter, write the equivalent of a newsletter, if you will, to anybody who's providing funds to you and say, here's how things are going. And I'd always start with the bad news. Say, here are the things that are going wrong. One of the most important things you can ever do is to build your credibility, and you do that by being brutally honest, by sharing the bad news right up front. We tell people in our company that, because as we deal with customers, we need to know in our own business what the bad news is. If we've got a customer in trouble, we want to know it quickly, so that in no small measure so that we can react quickly, because the likelihood that we can work out something that works for a customer and for us is greatly heightened if we get in there early and can start working on a solution. If we wait until things have blown up, our sort of options get very limited and not very pretty in terms of what we have to do with a customer. If we can start soon, early in the cycle of problems, we can usually figure out something that works for both. And so we tell our own employees that we want bad news, good news fast and bad news faster. And I think that's a good rule, basically, for any kind of communication to a financial partner in your business. I remember I had an experience years ago. I was in business school, and I was spending a weekend with a friend of ours, or our family's back in Lexington, Massachusetts, Michael Christian. Ladd, did you ever know Michael Christian?
Met him,
yeah. Michael Christian was, he was the founder of the Boston Company, which was a fabulous money management firm, now was later sold to American Express. I was at his home in a beautiful part of the woods outside of Boston there in Lexington, having dinner, and their house guest for the weekend, and the phone rang, and Michael answered the phone, and he was, they had some horses out back, and I listened to the kind of one half of the phone call, but it's always stayed with me. He was trying to sell this, he had a prospective buyer for one of his horses on the line, and he started talking about this horse, and he started talking about, I can't remember exactly, but, he's a little gimpy in one leg and, doesn't see very well. And I thought, this is kind of an interesting sales pitch. Because he was describing all of the defects of this animal that he was trying to sell. But then he transitioned into, on the other hand, this is a great horse for kids. He went on to kind of talk about the virtues of this horse he was selling. He hung up the phone, and I said that was the most kind of interesting sales pitch I've ever heard. It didn't sound to me like you were very persuasive as to why you should buy this horse, at least in the first part of the call. And he taught me a great lesson. He said, he said a couple of things. First of all, I don't want anybody to buy a horse and be calling me up and telling me, by the way, this horse got a bad leg and is half blind. But he said, secondly, by getting all that out on the table right up front, he said, I create a lot of credibility. He said, that's the way I negotiate. He said, I've created a lot of credibility when I start talking about the things that are right with a horse. And it's a lesson that I've applied numerous times, I guess, in my own life. I find it when I'm negotiating, everybody has their own style. Mine tends to be, sort of, look, here's what I see that I don't like. Here are the positives, and I find that it just helps a lot in your credibility. And credibility is everything when you're looking to access financing. So I'd suggest that. And finally, I would suggest that you always understand that being told no is sometimes a really healthy thing. It can be really painful to be told no. But I've come to realize that, one of the roles of a banker is to basically be the censor of some of our customers' more extravagant ideas. And happily for in cases where we are wrong, there are a lot of competitors, so you can kind of shop around. But sometimes, I tell our people that we don't do us or a customer any favor by providing financing to somebody that shouldn't have it and is going to end up in trouble as a result of it. There's a lot to be learned by the kind of feedback that you're going to get when you're told that this doesn't work or. Try and learn from that, because sometimes it's actually you may not realize it at the time, but it's actually the best favor that can be done to you is to keep you from becoming way over your head in debt with something that's just not going to make financial sense in the first place. So anyway, those are a few. Just a few tips. I'm going to wrap it up by, and we'll take some questions here, by just saying I think it's really interesting for me anytime I'm with a group of students to look back and think about how quickly time flies. I mean, one of the things that will surprise you most 30 years from now is where did 30 years go? And I envy all of you being sort of at the front door of starting amazing careers. I wish you all great success. I hope that you'll find balance in your lives, that you'll realize that building a great company or business isn't all there is in life. Something that maybe took me a little time myself to figure out.
but that there can be, you'll find a lot of satisfaction in whatever you do career-wise and doing something that's really fulfilling and where you feel like you're making a difference for people. Because that's where I found my great satisfaction, is being able to help people in my own way. And I hope you'll all have that same experience.
Our guest this evening, Harris Simmons from Zions Bank Corporation. Thanks for joining us from Salt Lake City. Technology Management Program has really enjoyed our day with you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Good to be with you.